Okay.
Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for tuning in. Today, we're talking about Cochise County. We're talking about insurance. We're talking about wineries. We're talking about all this wonderful stuff going on in southeastern Arizona with John Vanio of Vanio Insurance. Thank you so much for being my guest today. Welcome to the show.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
We were talking just before the show about some of the things going on around this area, and I kind of want to back up into that conversation for a little bit and get some background from you as far as what you're seeing. I know you're in Scottsdale, and
correct,
you do all sorts of insurance. What are you seeing in this area? Is it kind of a growing area or some potential, but not yet? What is your feeling about all of
this? I insure about four wineries now in southern Arizona, and I know two of them right now are in the midst of expanding. So I think the only thing that could probably ever slow down the growth down there would be maybe a water shortage of some sort. But as you and I talked about earlier, Kelly, land is abundant, land is inexpensive, I think Arizona wines are really starting to catch on.
Yeah, I think we have some award-winning wines coming out of this area now, so that's kind of exciting.
Yes, and I've talked to enough owners to kind of get a feel for it that, apparently when the wine industry was first developing, 10, 15 years ago, they had to go to California for everything. Okay, virtually everything,
right,
for their grapes and so on and so forth. And of course, transporting the grapes is very expensive and whatever. And so then you learn that the quicker that they could get going and get away from importing things from California, was they were well on their way to growing their business. I'm getting the sense that the Arizona wine industry is pretty much self-sufficient. And it's really good to see. I've always been an advocate of keeping tax dollars in your state,
right.
And I think it's just wonderful to see this thing taken off.
Yeah, I read something recently where about 70% of the wine grapes grown in Arizona are actually grown on the Chiricahua Bench area or in the Wilcox area. So I think that's really encouraging for that particular area.
Oh, absolutely. What we have to do, though, or I hope, as you and I talked about, have to start working on is getting that area more friendly, so people want to come down and stay and spend money. And as you mentioned, 70% of the grapes in Arizona are grown in that area, but all the wine tasting rooms started up in Jerome, and that area. Because Flagstaff's there and Cottonwood's there and all these areas were developed, with restaurants, a nice place to stay and whatever.
Right.
And I think it's just wonderful opportunity to Wilcox to start developing and bringing in places that people want to come down to and stay and have a nice meal and enjoy wine.
Right. And you like myself are from California. Have you seen any comparisons with the wine industry in California when it was newer with what's going on in Arizona? I know I've seen some similarities in Napa Valley where they had some growing pains and needed to do some infrastructure and get people excited about it. Are you seeing any of that in Arizona?
I think that That's a little different comparison because, as Napa Valley,
right,
the vineyards are right there with the tasting room. Okay,
right.
We don't have that really in northern Arizona, except for a few pockets, right around Cornville or in that area there.
Right.
But I think though we have a really wonderful opportunity to develop Wilcox into maybe not a Napa Valley like that, but an area like that where people come down and spend a weekend.
Right.
Go from winery to winery to winery, it could happen. It's absolutely beautiful country. We both know, So down in your area.
Yeah, it's a work in progress, I tell people, because a lot of people don't realize that wine grapes are grown anywhere in Arizona. But that is rapidly changing. Our wine industry statewide is really, I think, gaining some ground and some momentum. So it's definitely a work in progress, though. Let's shift gears a little bit and talk about insurance, because I know that's your business. If someone is thinking about, they already have a residence, and maybe they have some land, and they're thinking about adding something like an agricultural component, how does that change their overall insurance needs? And what is it that people don't understand about making that decision?
That's a great question, because as you kind of mentioned, as it evolved in southern Arizona, people, like, they worked out of their house, okay, and then,
right.
and then they attached a building and made it a tasting room, and typically I would first tell any winery vineyard owner, is first thing you would need to do is, if you have that structure insured by your homeowner's insurance, make sure you've contacted them and that they're okay with that, okay? Because remember, a homeowner's policy is made for you, the homeowner, and the residents of that home. It's not made for commercial purposes, okay? You know, people coming in and out, tasting wine, that's a liability exposure there, okay?
Right.
I've heard that a couple companies are okay with that. Majority are not. Okay, so what you'd want, you'd probably want to insure the building commercially, with, and of course you would want to include liquor liability, because that's huge. You know, it's a huge
right.
part of the exposure. And then of course we can add on to these policies. We can add on coverage for the equipment. We can add on equipment for wine in transit, for wine spoilage. Typically, how it works, the vineyard portion of things is very much like raising crops. Okay, as long as that grape is attached to the vine, okay, it's a crop. Okay, so that would have to be insured by crop insurance. Okay, but the very minute those grapes are snipped from the vine, okay, now that's when my insurance takes over, okay?
Okay.
So once it's removed from the vine, then that's when my insurance takes over for spoilage and transportation and that's pretty much what happened to that grape, is just, again, spoilage or lost in transit or whatever. That's kind of a benchmark for the, as far as insuring homeowners, insuring business. Now, the companies that will allow you to, you know, they say that, hey, we're okay with that. We understand what you're doing here. You will insure your home, and we'll put a rider on that for, you know, the winery exposure. You still need to get commercial insurance though for the equipment, because that would not ever be covered by a homeowner's policy. Okay.
Okay.
So you'd want to get it, and especially the outbuildings. You know, outbuildings that are used for processing. You know, if it's not attached to the main structure, and it's a separate building, then you'd want to make sure we have coverage for that. And of course, any of the equipment. You know, the tractors, whatever the equipment that goes to process the grapes, the equipment that you use for bottling. Okay, you'd want to make sure you get property coverage for that.
Okay. Yeah. The reason I ask that is because I have several. I know I wouldn't call them exactly friends, but I do know several people in this area, because land is so inexpensive out here and is so good for growing grapes. Many people, especially from California, although from other states as well, have come out here and they have built homes, or they've purchased a home that is on 20 or 40 acres, and now they are thinking seriously about putting in vineyards. Some people are doing a very small amount, like 1 acre. Some people that I know are doing 10 acres of grapevines. So is there a difference whether you have 1 acre or whether you have 40 acres as far as the insurance needs go? I mean, is there like a different level of coverage?
Not really. Acreage, all commercial insurance has certain has classifications that affect the rating. Okay, and then I'm not aware of anybody that uses land or size of land or acreage to rate the policy. Okay.
Okay.
Majority of it's going to be based on primarily sales. It's what's going to dictate the exposure.
Okay. Yeah, because I've had some real estate clients. I own Shirakawa Real Estate, and I have had several clients, it seems, in the last couple of months asking me, well, should we do 1 acre? Should we do 10 acres? And I'm like, I am not a winery. I don't know the answer to those questions. It's sort of everybody is sort of doing their own thing. And honestly,
sure.
I think it's sort of encouraging that people are coming out here with the intent of being a part of the wine industry and helping that industry grow. Now, in Scottsdale, you have a number of tasting rooms up in that area. Is that correct? You know, if
well, they seem to be growing. When I was when we were down there for the Wilcox Wine Festival about 6 weeks ago, I guess it was.
Yep.
I was talking to the owner of Eridus, and I guess he's just put a tasting room here, and then. Gosh, there were two or three others I was talking to that have tasting rooms now in Old Town. So,
right.
And of course, I live like 10 minutes from there, so it's good for me anyway. So, very convenient. Yeah, the one was Passion Cellars is the one I was thinking of. I think they just put a tasting room in Scottsdale. So.
Yeah, I think Lawrence Dunham Vineyards is up there as well. There may be one or two more that I'm not aware of, but. Have you been into some of the tasting rooms in Wilcox on Railroad Avenue, the little houses that they have?
Yes, we were down there. When we were down there, we took that Friday afternoon because, you know, the festival didn't start till Saturday. So we thought, let's just check these out. So we started out at a Flying Leap, and it turns out that's an old bar. And I guess one of the Earp brothers was killed in there. It's historical. Down the street, of course, was Rod Keeling's tasting rooms. We walked down there and checked that one out. And then across the tracks, the Eridus tasting room was there. And God forgive me, I can't remember the other one that was just two doors down from him. But so we did get to enjoy the four. Are there more than four? I think there's just four, right? Correct.
I think there is. Yeah, there's just four.
Okay.
Yeah.
How
would you compare those to the tasting rooms in Scottsdale? Are they on the same level? Are they a little bit different, or what? Because the reason I ask is because I've had people come in. I've been in some of these tasting rooms. Okay, more than once, and I've had people come in and say, "Wow, I was just up in Scottsdale, and the totally different vibe here." Is that what you find?
Absolutely. It's you know, Scottsdale is Scottsdale, and it's a very prestigious name, and I think people identify with it, and they present themselves a little differently. You know, you go down to Wilcox, and people a little more relaxed. People wearing jeans, you know, let their hair down a little bit. Totally different world. You know, totally different experience.
I really think Wilcox is developing. They still have a ways to go, as I said before, work in progress. But I think they're developing a very cool kind of artsy vibe in some of the tasting rooms and some of the wineries around here.
Yeah, so I agree. Yes. Well, yeah, you're right, because the Flying Leap one, they actually have art on the wall that you can purchase.
Yes.
The owner of Eridus totally remodeled that building inside. It's pretty cool. It's a lot of metal work. So they're all a little different. You know, they all have their own little personality, you know. But
we do have a number of local artists that are planning to, you know, come together with some of the tasting rooms and distribute local, or, you know, display local art, which I think is always a nice touch for a tasting room.
Oh, absolutely. absolutely. And that's when we talked earlier about how the tasting rooms kind of developed, you know, up in Jerome and that area, because that's a real artsy community up there.
Yes.
You know, and
yeah.
And that would be nice to see that to start to develop down in the Wilcox area.
Yeah, that's in the works, I understand, from a number of people. So that's kind of exciting. Wilcox, many people who have gone, you know, between Tucson and El Paso or Phoenix and El Paso, anywhere along that I-10 corridor, Wilcox is easy to miss. And people, you know, kind of get off the freeway and get gas and get back on. So it's exciting to me, because I live here, to see some people kind of coming together and say, you know what, get off at Wilcox. We've got some really cool things happening.
Yes.
So that's, I guess you have to start somewhere. And in Wilcox, we're kind of starting around 1957. So that's kind of the vibe, but it's a very cool historic town, and it's going to be wonderful to see some of these changes happening. So now, how, going back to insurance, because I'm curious, how did you decide to start your own insurance company? I know in real estate, people always ask me, why did I decide to do my own company rather than use either, you know, like a Remax or, you know, Century 21, one of the nationwide companies. Why did you decide to do your own thing?
Well, I've been at this for 24 years, and the first 15 years, I was what they call a captive agent. I represented a company that you can only represent one product, and it was a great education, but at the same time, it was very limiting. You were subject to their product line, and it was typically very somewhat narrow, especially in the commercial world. And so after 15 years, I thought, you know, I really would like to have more options for people. And so we made a break, and a little over 9 years ago, we started our own independent insurance brokerage. And we touch it all. We have somebody that handles our health insurance for us. We have somebody that handles the life insurance. That's not a big part of our business, but as you know, and probably like in your business too, you know, once people get to know you, and they really call you for almost anything, you know.
Right.
And so the bulk of our business, of course, is personal insurance, and which my wife is my partner, and she completely handles the personal insurance. And then I handle the commercial end of the insurance.
What is that like, being in business with your spouse? I've always wondered about that, and my husband and I'm pretty sure would kill each other. So how does that work out?
You know, we are asked this all the time, and I think the only answer that I can identify is that when we made this break and set this thing up, you know, we became departmentalized, okay? And personal lines is her baby. I don't, except for answering a question now and then on a claim situation, I don't even know how to go to the management system and tell a person what their bill is, okay? I have no idea. She doesn't cross over into my world. We drive separately, and we don't talk about work at home.
That's great advice for any couple. Don't talk about work at home. That's an awesome way to do it. I'm you know, you're very lucky that works. I've always been curious about how people make it work, and it seemed like you've really got it down to where it really does work. So good for you.
Yeah.
Have you always worked in a sales capacity? Because it seems like people who do always do.
Yes. My when I my first job after I graduated from college, I went to work for and some, the younger people won't remember this name, but my generation of course would. I went to work for a company named Janssen Swimwear. And the logo was a diving girl, and I was hired out of the Los Angeles office, and they bounced around the country a little bit. I spent a little time in Denver, spent a little time in Chicago, and then in 1980 they moved me here to Arizona, and so I became account executive, salesperson for Janssen Swimwear in the state of Arizona. I also had New Mexico, and Las Vegas was my territory. And that was a great job. It was a very seasonal job. You'd work about 2 or 3 months and have 2 or 3 months off, and we were paid straight commission. Okay, it was just a great job, but those jobs don't exist anymore. You know, those of us.
No.
Well, you know, back in 1980 when I moved here, there were like 4 department stores that were based, buying offices here anyway, in Arizona. Okay.
Wow.
And by the time 1990 rolled around, they all had become. They used to call the term central buy, where one of their offices in a larger city took over the buying responsibility. So overnight, my account base was gone. And and being from California, I don't get me wrong, I loved growing up there. It was a lot of fun. But I just looked and I said, you know, I don't want to raise my kids there. I just don't want to do that. So I ended up had no choice. I parted ways with the clothing industry. And that's kind of how I kind of fell into the insurance industry, and that's how it happened. And I've always been a commission salesperson.
Yeah, it seems like there's a type of person that can really thrive on that, and then there are people that my husband calls the normal people who can't even conceive of why on earth you would want to do that. And I've always been. You know, my own boss, and it's always been that way for me, and I'm very comfortable with it, and I think people are either comfortable with it or they are certainly not.
I agree with you 100%, and it's, as you know, it's not easy. You know, there are lean times. You know, I think both of our industries somewhat follow the economic cycles. And mm-hmm. there's times when it's lean and tough, and then there's times when it's of course a lot more enjoyable. We're all selling. We really really love what we do. You know, it's funny because you know the people that have never couldn't even grasp being on commission. They would worry themselves sick of how they're going to make their ends meet, and I've never worried about that. I just always believe that if you treat people right, you know, show them the best integrity, okay, you'll always do well. You'll always do well.
Right.
You know,
right.
And so I've been at what this quite a long time now. So I entered the sales world in 1978. So I've been doing this quite a long time. So
yeah, I got my real estate license in 1979. So yes.
Oh yeah. You understand? Yeah. Yes.
Yes. It's something that I tell people, the highs are higher, but the lows are lower. It's
mm-hmm.
kind of, you learn to roll with the punches. So that's, yeah, definitely. What do you think about the future of Arizona as you see it? Are we growing? Are we stagnant? I know we mentioned earlier very briefly that the only thing that could really derail wineries here is a water issue. And I know there's been a lot of talk about water issues in this valley. And most of them, when you really look at the facts, are not that huge an issue, particularly for crops that use drip irrigation like wine grapes. But overall, what do you think? Which way are we going?
Well, I think Arizona needs to get a little more proactive right now and
mm-hmm.
take heed of some of the things that California's done, okay? We're a desert for the most part. Why do we have grass, okay?
Right.
You know, if you want to have grass on a golf course, it should be affluent water, you know? So I think we really need to get on board with that. And I think that as the state continues to develop education, and that, you know, that's, people don't understand that that's been a big hurdle here for a long, long time. Is that companies come here, and they look and they go, you know, your Scholastic rating's terrible. Why would we set up here? Because they're looking at the candidates you're going to feed them to work in their businesses. Well, I think it sounds like they're turning the corner on that. So I think I think Arizona's sitting pretty for quite a long time, and I think you're going to see a lot of flight, continue to see the flight from the states like California. I mean, it's just I'm not picking on those poor guys, but my God, it's impossible for a small business person to do business there. It's just a
Right.
And so I think we're going to have a lot of things that continue to shove people our way, and on the other side of the country, as the winters they become progressively worse. I mean, I mean, would you rather live in 10 below, or would you rather live in like 80 degrees in March in Arizona?
Right.
So
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
I think we're doing the right things. I think the state's doing the right things to continue to have growth.
I agree with you. I would say some of the small communities do have award-winning schools, but boy, you really have to look for them.
Yes.
It's not widely known. I know out here where I live, Ash Creek Elementary is a distinguished school and has been for years, and yet no one knows about it. It's sort of like a huge secret
Sure.
that they don't tell anyone. What is your favorite thing about Cochise County? What is it here that you think is a big secret that should get out?
Well, and I have to tell you that except for years ago when I was a clothing rep and I used to travel the state like a couple times a year and basically, like you said, just kind of drive through Wilcox, or stay the night,
Right.
because I was tired of driving in from New Mexico.
Right.
I never really spent a lot of time down there. And this last trip down there, my wife and I went down for the Wilcox Wine Festival. And on that Saturday morning of the festival, it was rainy and gray. And so we just took a drive. And we went to the Chiricahua National Monument, got up to the top. We're in the clouds, okay? But I'd never seen rock formations like that before in my life. It was just beautiful, and it's just it's it. I think people just need to get down and see the beauty.
Right.
Arizona is a very unique state, and
Right.
there's a lot of beauty. The desert has its own beauty. Flagstaff has its own beauty. Okay, the area down there with the Chiricahuas has its own beauty. So I think people just need to get down there, and again, they could start maybe getting a couple resorts going or things for people to come and stay the weekend. Because it's such a nice pace of life too. It's such a you slow down. You have to slow down. When you're down
Right.
there, and I found it very enjoyable to be down there.
Yeah, we have a couple minutes left. I agree with you by the way on the Chiricahuas. I tell people those are my mountains. I know they're called the Chiricahuas, but they're really mine. That's my backyard. That's where I live. But we have a couple minutes. I want to make sure everyone knows how to contact you. So if you could give that information to people, I know they will appreciate it.
Okay, well, my name is, of course, John Vanyo, Vanyo, and you can contact me by phone at 480-998-4014. That's the office phone. If they want to learn more about our what we do with the wine industry, we actually have a landing page set up with a video on it for people to check out, and it's Vanyo Winery Insurance, just all one word, .com. Enter it in your browser, click on it, and take a look at it, or you can email me at John with an H, John, at vanyoinsurance.com.
Perfect. Thank you so much for being on the show. I know I've learned quite a bit about insurance, and I'm sure everyone else has too. Have a beautiful, beautiful Thanksgiving, and we'll
You
have
do
to
the
have you
same.
back again.
I look forward to it. And again, anybody listening, feel free to call me anytime with questions. I'd be glad to share information with you. I expect nothing in return. I'll be glad to answer questions for you and take a look at what you have and tell you what you might want to do and whatever. So I'll just please feel free to contact me if any questions they have.
Great. I'm sure they
All
will.
right.
I will put links on the show description for those of you who missed that information. thank you guys for listening as always. Have a beautiful, beautiful day and happy Thanksgiving. Bye.
Bye-bye, Kelly. Take care.
Thanks, you too.